This is abundance. Rules of Engagement. A New Path. Habits can dull us to the real question many people ask at some time in their lives. When we stop and think, we ought to consider why we are here. Is there a reason for you to be here on this planet at this particular time? Have you thought about what it is you are here to do? Do you have a higher purpose? Is there a nagging suspicion in the back of your mind telling you there has to be more? Perhaps it is time to explore the unexplored part of ourselves. Henry David Thoreau once said, "When it's time to die, let us not discover that we have never lived." Reforming our lives is not an easy thing. Apparently, I am supposed to attend more wedding receptions, since twice in 2 days, I have been reprimanded by the chaotic forces of my life. Yesterday, one of my former students, again, invited me to attend her wedding reception. On a campus of thousands of people, she and her sister found me in my car and reminded me about the wedding. She even turned to her sister and insisted, "I never attend receptions." It's true. I am a little antisocial when it comes to keeping in touch with former students. I usually have so much to do with my current students that I tend to lose track of the old ones. I also have church responsibilities which would normally include attending an unusually high number of wedding receptions. So let's just say I probably have been avoiding one of my social duties. When we talk of reforming ourselves, going to social functions may not be at the top of the list, but someone or something is trying to get me a message about honoring the norms of our society, and that includes celebrating the fact people want to spend their lives together. People came to my wedding reception. Why am I so stubborn? Some of these social customs are the glue that hold our society together, and with so many distractions in our lives, it is easy to neglect the things that make us a society. While I'm on the subject, I have been reading some of the writings of Eric Hoffer this week, and he believed we join mass movements because of the emptiness we feel in life. In his book, The True Believer, he tried to help us understand why people would support Nazi policies, and he concluded most people would rather be told what to do than use the freedom we have to find out what we really want to do. He also said that when people are left to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. I hope this is an opportunity today for you to really examine your life and see if you're doing something that makes a difference in your life and the lives of others. When we get outside of our prejudices, hatreds, and envies, we are really able to do those things we're meant to do. As Eric Hoffer observed, people hate those who remind them of their inadequacies, of their own shortcomings. We need to examine the causes we so vehemently support and wonder out loud just what the energy could be better spent doing. You know what it is. No one else can tell you what you need to be doing. You know what would be a better use of your time. The real question is whether you're going to get up off the couch and do it. It doesn't have to be a thermonuclear reaction. It may be you just need to attend more wedding receptions and affirm the urge of most in this world to try and make the world a better place for themselves, but also for someone else. We all sacrifice something to exist in this human sphere, and that might be paying more taxes than we want so the roads will be better. It might be getting paid less than we want for a more satisfying job. It may be using our millions to make the lives of others better. There really is something about being excited about our own causes. We don't need the direction of someone else. We don't need marching orders. We don't have to say someone gave us an order we were just following. We'll be focused on what is right and what is wrong, and we'll be very clear about what we can do about it. If what we think we need to do involves tearing down someone else, well, then probably we need to ponder our true purpose some more. There's today's challenge. Can we find out what it is we really want to be doing and not just following somebody else? Good luck. It is harder than it sounds. But do invite me to your wedding reception. I'd like to offer my interpretation of "Twas the Night Before Christmas." Clement Clark Moore wrote this poem in 1822, and it's now the tradition in many American families to read this poem every Christmas Eve. It really redefined our image of Christmas and Santa Claus. If you think about prior to the creation of this story, St. Nicholas, the patron saint of children, had never even been associated with the sleigh or reindeer. The author was reticent, didn't really want people to know that he'd published the poem, but a family friend sent this poem to the New York Sentinel with the condition that the author was to remain anonymous. Now, the first publication date was the 23rd of December, 1823. It's an immediate success. And not until 1844 did Clement Clark Moore claim ownership when the work was included in a book of his poetry. He came from a prominent family. His father was Benjamin Moore, who was the Bishop of New York. He is famous for officiating at the inauguration of George Washington. "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" by Clement C. Moore. "'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and eight tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face, and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowlful of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang away to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle. They all flew away like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. an editorial by Francis Farsalis Church. Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Virginia O'Hanlon, 115 West 95th Street. Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, in his intellect as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not to believe in Santa Claus. You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all of the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives. And he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia. Nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood. This is Abundance. I am your host, Dane Allred. You'll hear a lot of different things on Abundance. You've just heard a selection from Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement called X-Ray Insight. 'Twas the Night Before Christmas by Clemency Moore. And, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. From Literature Out Loud, these and other selections are available 24/7 on the internet under Abundance. Maybe some musings about my week, usually a selection from famous writers or a poem or two, a chapter from my murder mystery or some original poetry, maybe something to motivate you and me. Watch out, you may gain some insight into yourself and everyone else. You never know what's next on Abundance. Thank you. A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Stave 2. The First of the Three Spirits. When Scrooge awoke, the chimes of a neighboring church struck the four quarters, so he listened for the hour. To his great astonishment, the heavy bell tolled with a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy one. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor who drew them. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as like an old man. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on the skin. "Are you the spirit, sir, whose coming was foretold to me?" "I am."
"Who and what are you?"
"I am the ghost of Christmas past."
"Long past?"
"No, your past." Scrooge then made bold to inquire what business brought him there.
"Your welfare, your reclamation, take heed."
It put out its strong hand as it spoke and clasped him gently by the arm.
"Rise and walk with me."
The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose. They passed through the wall and stood upon an open country road with fields on either hand.
"Good heaven! I was bred in this place. I was a boy here."
"You recollect the way?"
inquired the spirit.
"Remember it. I could walk it blindfolded."
"Strange to have forgotten it for so many years," observed the ghost. "Let us go on."
Why did his cold eye glisten? Why was he filled with gladness? What was Merry Christmas to Scrooge? Out upon Merry Christmas! What good had it ever done to him? The ghost stopped at a certain warehouse door and asked Scrooge if he knew it.
"Know it," said Scrooge. "I was apprenticed here."
They went in. At the sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig sitting behind such a high desk, Scrooge cried in great excitement.
"Why, it's old Fezziwig, bless his heart. It's Fezziwig alive again."
Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and called out in a comfortable, oily, rich, fat, jovial voice,
"Yo-ho there, Ebenezer, Dick!"
Scrooge's former self, now a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow apprentice.
"Dick Williams, to be sure, bless me, yes, there he is."
"Yo-ho, my boys," said Fezziwig. "No more work tonight. Christmas Eve, Dick, Christmas Ebenezer. Let's have the shutters up before a man can say Jack Robinson. Hilly-ho, clear away, my lads, and let's have lots of room here."
Clear away. There was nothing they wouldn't have cleared away or couldn't have cleared away with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. The warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler with a music book. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came three Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came six young followers whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In they all came, anyhow and everyhow. There were dances, and there were forfeits, and more dances, and there was cake, and there were mince pies. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig. Away they all went, 20 couples at once, hands half round and back again the other way, down the middle and up again. When the clock struck 11, this domestic ball broke up. Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations, one on either side of the door, and shaking hands with every person individually as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas. When everybody had retired but the two prentices, they did the same to them. And thus the cheerful voices died away, and the lads were left to their beds, which were under a counter in the back shop.
"A small matter," said the ghost. to make these silly folk so full of gratitude?
Small, echoed Scrooge.
Why, is it not? He has spent but a few pounds of your mortal money, 3 or 4, perhaps. Is that so much that he deserves this praise?
It isn't that, Spirit. He has the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome, a pleasure or a toil. The happiness he gives is quite as great as if it cost a fortune.
He felt the Spirit's glance and stopped. What is the matter?
Nothing in particular.
Something, I think.
No. I should like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk just now, that's all.
His former self turned down the lamps as he gave utterance to the wish, and Scrooge and the ghost again stood side by side in the open air.
My time grows short. Quick!
This was not addressed to Scrooge or to anyone whom he could see, but it produced an immediate effect, for again Scrooge saw himself. He was older now, a man in the prime of life. There was an eager, greedy, restless motion in the eye, which showed the passion that had taken root, and where the shadow of the growing tree would fall. He was not alone, but sat by the side of a fair young girl in whose eyes there were tears, which sparkled in the light that shone out of the ghost of Christmas past.
"It matters little," she said softly. "To you, very little. Another idol has displaced me, and if it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, I have no just cause to grieve."
"What idol has displaced you?"
"A golden one. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one until the master passion, gain, engrosses you. Have I not?"
"What then? Even if I have grown so much wiser, what then? I am not changed toward you, am I?"
"Our contract is an old one. It was made when we were both poor. You are changed. When it was made, you were another man."
"I was a boy."
"I can release you."
"Have I ever sought release?"
"In words, no. Never."
"In what, then?"
"In a changed nature, in an altered spirit, in another atmosphere of life, another hope as its great end, in everything that made my love of any worth or value in your sight. But if you were free today, tomorrow, yesterday, can I even believe that you would choose a dowerless girl? And I release you. May you be happy in the life you have chosen."
She left him, and they parted.
"Spirit," said Scrooge, "show me no more. Conduct me home. Why do you delight to torture me?"
"I told you, these were shadows of the things that have been. That they are what they are. Do not blame me."
"Remove me. I cannot bear it. Leave me. Take me back. Haunt me no longer."
Scrooge was conscious of being exhausted and overcome by an irresistible drowsiness, and further, of being in his own bedroom, and had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep.
Dane Allred's World of Hurt, more hiking stupidity. My journey up the mountain behind our home wasn't just about bees and wasps. Another surprise of the hike was on one of the crags that lined the ridgeline. It was one of the topmost and had a large flat area where you could stand and look out over the entire Utah Valley and even see some of Juab County. Just next to the edge of the outcropping, I noticed a small brown circle which looked out of place in the natural setting. After I looked closer, I could see that it was a penny. I picked it up and looked closely at the date. It was from the 1940s and, for all I knew, had been left there by some past hiker 50 years before me. I thought a second about leaving it there for some future hiker, but it was too irresistible to pass by. I only wish I had a new penny in my pocket to replace it. To tell you how unprepared I was, I had taken a baggie full of ice and drank the water as it melted, and soon was out of water. Fortunately, this was June, and as I climbed higher, I found patches of snow where I could renew my water supply. The really idiotic thing about this whole adventure is that no one knew where I was going. I hadn't left a note saying where I was, so if I got hurt, there would be no rescue party. I had on the wrong shoes, and I hadn't brought enough water. But still, I climbed on because it was there. I've always wondered about that phrase in mountains. We climb it because it is there. But I can tell you that it really is true. I kept climbing because there was more mountain in front of me. Farther up the mountain, I finally came to the first of the ridge tops of the mountains. From here, it would be easy walking across the ridges from mountain to mountain. And at the top of each mountain, there seemed to be another mountain, which was just a little higher. If you're going to climb that far, you might as well reach the mountain top. I knew I had to start down pretty soon to beat darkness before I got to the bottom. So I went to the second tallest mountain, which was next to Buckley, I think. It probably would have taken another 30 minutes to go to that other peak, but I decided not to press my luck and started down. The hike down was not the same path I followed up, since I had climbed a few small cliffs which were not higher than 10 feet. I had fallen 10 feet enough not to worry about falling that far, but I didn't want to be falling down then on purpose. So on at least two of the parts of the downhill journey, I found myself faced with two decisions: slide down the rock slide or walk through the thick underbrush. My shoes had almost completely fallen apart by this time. The soles were flapping from the uppers, and they threatened to come completely apart at any minute. When I got home later that day, I simply threw them away. They were totally thrashed. Sliding down a rock on purpose is very fun, but I strongly caution anyone who hasn't survived at least 25 mishaps like I have not to try this at home. The loose rocks had made a 500-foot slope of small pebbles and stones. They were loose enough that as you stepped onto them, they would slide under your feet and you would actually be surfing the rocks. I had to be careful I didn't get going too fast, and from my skiing experience, I knew when and how to slow up and then when to stop. My ankles did get banged up by a couple of larger rocks, but I've never experienced anything like that since. I made it back and immediately collapsed into bed. I'd been hiking for 7 hours and had gone from about 4,500 feet elevation where my house is to about 11,000 feet at the top of the mountain and then back down again. I don't know how many miles I hiked that day, but I had hiked over 2 miles straight up and down. I once tried to figure it out on a topographical map, and it seemed like it was about 11 miles total. I slept for about 15 hours straight and woke up about noon the next day. The family was away, so there was no one around to complain about how foolish I had been or how late I was sleeping. Stupid? Yes. A great adventure? Absolutely.
Thank you.
Bright Space. Diversity by Dane Allred.
The universe wanted to find out all that there was to know. It created you and me. In the bright space, we all enjoyed each other's company, celebrating the unlimited number of ways this universe wanted to discover all there was to know. Even when you and I experienced the same thing, we experienced it in completely different ways. We can try to explain to someone else what we have seen and felt, and another person would explain the same experience in a completely different way. But the opposite is also true. When we are gathered together, united for a purpose with hundreds or thousands of different people, all desiring the same goal, the same unity, we are feeling a part of that oneness we once felt. In the bright space. Though we are diverse individuals with different backgrounds, preferences, desires, and goals, at that one moment, during that one time we are gathered together, we feel as one. We shout as one. We act as one. What a great mystery to be contemplated. We are apart, and yet, we can be one. It's that same feeling we get when we meet someone new, but they really aren't new to us because we were together before in the bright space. There is that spark of recognition, that feeling of familiarity, that feeling of oneness, even though we are quite different from one another. While we spin in our own spheres on this world, spinning through space at unbelievable speeds, we take the time to know others, to help others, to seek that purpose for which we were sent here. To experience what this life will offer us, and experience all the others we will ever meet as we travel on our voyage. Someday, when we have experienced all this life has to offer, we will return to the bright space, the place that is no place, where there is no here and then, but only now, and celebrate our oneness and diversity. Us Just Is by Dane Allred. Is justice a miscellany of difference,
our assortment of diversity, the variegated variety, a medley of similarity? The jumbled multi-mixture, this hodgepodge or concoction, the fusion of division, the blending combination is just us. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 71 by William Shakespeare. No longer mourn for me when I am dead. Then you shall hear the surly, sullen bell give warning to the world that I am fled from this vile world, with vilest worms to dwell. Nay, if you read this line, remember not the hand that writ it. For I love you so that I, in your sweet thoughts, would be forgot, if thinking on me then should make you woe. Oh, if I say, you look upon this verse when I perhaps compounded am with clay, do not so much as my poor name rehearse, but let your love, even with my life, decay. Lest the wise world should look into your moan and mock you with me after I am gone. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 72 by William Shakespeare. Oh, lest the world should task you to recite what merit lived in me, that you should love after my death, dear love, forget me quite, for you in me can nothing worthy prove, unless you would devise some virtuous lie to do more for me than mine own desert, and hang more praise upon deceased I than niggard truth would willingly impart. O, lest your true love may seem false in this, that you for love speak well of me untrue, my name be buried where my body is, and live no more to shame, nor me, nor you. For I am shamed by that which I bring forth, and so should you, to love things nothing worth. Thank you.
Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 73 by William Shakespeare. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare, ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the death bed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 74 by William Shakespeare. But be contented, when that fell arrest without all bail shall carry me away. My life hath in this line some interest, which for memorial still with thee shall stay. When thou reviewest this, thou dost review the very part was consecrate to thee. The earth can have but earth which is his due. My spirit is thine, the better part of me. So then thou hast but lost the dregs of life, the prey of worms, my body being dead, the coward conquest of a wretch's knife, too base of thee to be remembered. The worth of that is that which it contains, and that is this, and this with thee remains. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 75 by William Shakespeare. So are you to my thoughts as food to life, or as sweet season showers are to the ground. And for the peace of you I hold such strife as twixt a miser and his wealth is found. Now proud as an enjoyer, and anon, doubting the filching age will steal his treasure. Now counting best to be with you alone, then bettered that the world may see my pleasure. Sometime all full with feasting on your sight, and by, clean starved for a look. Possessing or pursuing no delight, save what is had or must from you betook. Thus do I pine and surfeit day by day, or gluttoning on all, or all away. We're halfway through the Shakespeare sonnets. You can enjoy these anytime on Literature Out Loud at DaneAllred.com. Get a CD of me reading 6 selections for the Christmas season, and I'll send you a book with all of the text so you can follow along. Only $9.99 for the audio CD and the personally autographed book. Go to DaneAllred.com to order, or go to DaneAllred.com right now and listen for free. You've been listening to Dane Allred and Abundance. Today we've examined diversity number 346 from my list I call 1001 Thanks. It's a list of the 1001 things I'm thankful to find in this universe of abundance. Now get out there and find your own abundance.